Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today we visit Portland for Breakfast with Charlie, a presentation of the University of Southern Maine's Muskie School of Public Service Professor of Public Policy and Management, Charles Colgan's economic forecast for 2011. You can find the audio for this program, along with the slides used in the presentation, online at mpbn.net. As with all Speaking in Maine programs, this one will be available to stream online or to download as a podcast, a service made possible by member support. Just look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand to access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the speaker is Kevin Freeman, Pizzagalli Construction Director of Business Development and Chair of USM Corporate Partners.
It is my pleasure to introduce our featured speaker, Professor Charlie Colgan of USM's Muskie School of Public Service. Professor Colgan is the chair of the Muskie School's Community Planning and Development Program and associate director of the Maine Center for Business and Economic Research at USM. Dr. Colgan is also chair of this state's Consensus Economic Forecasting Commission, a position he has held since the commission was created in 1992. Prior to coming to USM, he served 12 years in the Maine State Planning Office, including positions as Maine State Economist and Special Assistant to the Governor for International Trade. Please welcome Professor Charlie Colgan.
Good morning. So I'm spending most of my time here not shaking hands. This is for your own safety. People have asked me if I have the bug that's going around. I say I don't know if it's the bug, but it's my bug. And I'm keeping it and keeping it. I will try and get through this with as minimal interruption from my sinuses as I can get away with. So the question at the beginning of each year is what happened in the last year and what's the outlook for this year? This is obviously a very pivotal point here at the what really is, I think, the turning point of the Great Recession, what will become has become known as the Great Recession and the not-so-great recovery. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why that's the case, why 2010 didn't quite live up to expectations, though in fact in some ways it was right on my forecast, and what's ahead for 2011. In last year's presentation, I looked back at the decade of the noughties, not being the English term for double zeros, looked back at that decade and tried to figure out what kind of progress we had made. The answer was not much. Today, at the beginning of the teens, we will look ahead to the next decade with a particular focus on what will, for the next 3 or 4 years, be the single most important and dominant economic and political set of discussions that will take place around the federal debt and deficit and see what some of the implications of that are for the U.S. and for Maine. 2010 was not a great year in terms of the economy. It was expected to be better for a whole bunch of reasons. It wound up being pretty ho-hum, which is a little surprising given that we were coming out of a recession and we really should have been able to pick up a much more rapid pace of growth towards the end of the year, 6 quarters into recovery. And the question that really has been on my mind for the last 6 months as I've done these presentations, and some of you may have seen this metaphor, I'm continuing it this year. Last year, you may recall, my visual metaphor at the beginning of the presentation was a picture of the woods. And I asked, are we out of the woods yet? I said, I didn't think we were out of the woods yet, but we could see it from where we were. This year, my visual metaphor is a little bit more downbeat. The question that I have is whether 2010 was a pothole on the road to recovery, or something much more serious in the shape of a cliff that we are about to drive over. I'm going to make the case for both the pothole and the cliff metaphors. I'll say that my forecast is based in the pothole, that 2010 was an aberration, but that many of the forces that made 2010 a difficult year are still out there lurking and could yet turn the forecast around. In general, my forecast is a little more upbeat than last year's in some ways, but there's some very high risks to it. So let's look first at where we've been. This is the GDP of the U.S. from 2007 quarter four through 2010 quarter three, the last quarter for which figures are available. The components of GDP are shown, and the colors represent net exports in red, the government in blue, net investment in yellow, and consumption in light blue. What you see here is the unfolding of the recession in 2008 as investment primarily in the housing sector essentially comes to a screeching halt. In the second half, the third quarter of 2008, you see consumption showing a dramatic drop in the third quarter. That's when Lehman Brothers collapses, the financial system seizes up, everybody panics, they desert the mall, and the auto dealers and everybody else on en masse. And you see two consecutive quarters of falling consumption levels. You see a negative 6.8% annual change in the GDP in the first quarter, in the fourth quarter of 2008. And you see businesses, seeing what consumers are doing, businesses massively pull back. And why you see those big yellow bars. Then, beginning in the third quarter of 2009, you see the numbers begin to turn positive at 1.6% as the fiscal stimulus package begins to kick in. And since the third quarter of 2009, you see positive numbers throughout that period. But you also see the numbers coming down from 5% in the fourth quarter of 2009, 3.7% the first quarter of 2010, 1.7% the second quarter, and 2% in the third quarter. The fourth quarter will probably come in at around 2.3 to 2.4%. So after a really good start to the recovery, the GDP growth has slowed significantly. A major reason for that, you'll see, is the red bars, which is net exports. And this is the primary effect of the European sovereign debt crisis, about which I'm going to speak more a little bit later because it remains a major threat to the economy. Essentially, the sovereign debt crisis caused the dollar to strengthen significantly against other currencies, made our exports more expensive, and made imports much cheaper into the U.S. So in the latter stages of 2010, rather than our stimulative packages helping out American goods producers, we were essentially helping ourselves to buy things in increasing quantities from foreigners because of their depreciation in the dollar, or the appreciation in the dollar. The ARRA, or the stimulus package, had a significant effect in strengthening the economy, or I should say cushioning the economy. Rough rule of thumb, ARRA in total replaced about one-third of the fall in aggregate demand, about one-third of the fall in jobs. So ARRA was big enough to cushion the blow by about one-third of the economic drop across the economy, not enough to make the economy not enough to completely solve the recession. It also moved the point of the turning point in GDP growth ahead about two quarters. So if ARRA had not been enacted, the recovery in GDP would not have started until early 2010 as opposed to mid-2009. It was, by any standard of economic policy, a fairly successful program for its size. By political standards, of course, it was a disaster. because it failed. Fixing one-third of the problem was simply unacceptable to people. It's not clear that a policy program that was big enough to fix it would have been acceptable either. But either way, what was enacted worked in terms of what it could do economically, but still wound up being a disaster politically. And we no longer, of course, the word stimulus has, of course, been banned from the English language. ARRA will peter out in the first two quarters of 2011. The last of the stimulus money will get spent probably by the end of 2011. But for all intents and purposes, the stimulus essentially had all of its effects through the middle of 2010 and has not been having a significant effect on the economy since then. For the last three recessions, going back to the 1990-91 recession, we have talked about jobless recoveries. And this recovery is, unfortunately, an all too vivid example of what we mean by that. The black line here represents the GDP growth rate quarterly. The green line, the light green bar, represents the number of employed people in the United States, which has fallen by about 8.5 million. The dark green represents the number of unemployed people, which has gone from about 8 million to about 16 million. And the number has stayed at 16 million for most of the last 2 years. There has been virtually no change in the number of unemployed people at about 8 to 8.5 million over 2 years, despite six quarters now of growth in the GDP. So this pretty much defines the concept of jobless recovery. Basically, the economy and output, business profits have all recovered, but jobs have simply not been there. And this, as it was a year ago when I spoke, remains the hinge of the economy, because if we do not get the job market back working again, this recovery cannot sustain itself too much longer. Simply on the because the government is not going to be there, if the consumer is not going to be there, and we're going to continue to have problems in foreign markets, there's just not going to be anything to keep the economy up anymore. So, as we turn from a picture of where we are, what's the argument for a puddle? We're at a temporary stage here. The nature of the recession is such that we were always going to have a terrible time getting out of it. 2.5 years is probably not all that unusual or unexpected given the depth of the debt crisis and the fiscal system crisis that we went to. And so don't panic. We've had some problems, but we're going to get through it okay, and 2011 is the time that the turnaround is going to come. This is the pothole theory. Okay, in support of the pothole theory, hours worked steadily increased in the U.S. and in Maine, as I'll show you, throughout 2010. An increase in hours worked is the necessary precondition to hiring. Basically, before you start bringing people on to full or part-time jobs, you increase the hours that are worked of the people who are already working for you. And so you have to see this as the trend that leads to the eventual change from essentially no hiring to a hiring posture. In addition, historically, there's a very close relationship between profits and jobs. Essentially, as profits grow, job growth follows about 3 to 4 months later. And if you look here, this is the green line represents profit growth lag 3 quarters against job growth. You can see a very close relationship here going back to 1970. There's a very close relationship between profit growth and 3 months later hiring. And as you can see, end of this graph, you can see profits have surged over the last year without the accompanying hiring growth. So if this trend were to continue, it suggests that it's about time that businesses, essentially with adequate cash reserves, can afford to start looking for hiring. There is some evidence of this. Private sector hiring may finally be getting in gear. This is job growth in the economy, 2009 and 2010. You can see that private sector job growth was the major drag on the economy through 2009. And in the second half of 2010, private sector job growth turned modestly positive, 40 to 100,000 jobs a month, not anywhere what we need. I mean, we need about 250,000 jobs a month to get things really moving. But private sector hiring has turned positive. And the major drag on hiring right now is in the public sector. And as I'll talk about, that remains probably the big issue in the job market over the next 2 years. I said that one of the problems we've had in 2010 is that the American economy has been kind of held up by federal dollars, international trade situation has been such that we've largely been buying a lot of what we've been buying from other countries. And this is primarily because much of what we've been buying has been goods. We have bought much more in the way of goods than services, and we are a service-dominated economy. Over the last couple of quarters, we have begun to see Americans buying more and more services. Those are things we do not import much of. And so this is another sign that we are, as our economy is turning, we're essentially going to shift back to the to buying things from the domestic economy, which will have an additional forward effect on the overall growth pattern. Another reason to be optimistic is that household debt burdens, which were horrible, have been falling very fast. My friend Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics says that the current rate of deleveraging and interest rates debt service will be back to early 1990s levels by this time next year in the household sector. This is, in fact, another reason why I think things have been very slow is the household sector has been extremely responsive to the debt levels that they've faced and has spent a lot of time not spending money, but rebuilding their balance sheets. And as that begins to take effect in terms of getting people more comfortable with their household debt levels, some expansion of consumption is more likely to occur. Again, we're going to see it. We see some preliminary signs on this in the latest auto sales numbers. People are beginning to come back, at least to the American manufacturers. Toyota is still apparently having problems. all of these forces suggest that we are at the stage where things are going to turn generally in favor of both expansion in the consumer sector and in hiring. On the policy side, the Fed has committed, recognizing that traditional monetary policy instruments are no longer effective, the Fed has adopted a recommendation from that radical left-wing economist Milton Friedman to undertake the purchase of long-term government bonds in a process which has become known as QE2. it is a manifestation of Fed speak. That's a slightly different language than English. It's a manifestation of Fed speak, which basically what it's saying is we're going to increase the money supply, and by increasing the money supply, we're going to hope to push long-term interest rates, which we don't generally affect with our discount rate policy, down further, and encourage by increasing the money supply, put more money out there for lending and expansion. This will the current policy is scheduled to work through the end of 2011. So what's the downside? Where is the cliff? Are we still at some danger of falling off and going back into recession? clearly, one of the big threats out there is the European debt crisis. As I've shown you, this is not simply a question of what happens in Athens or in other places in Europe. This has directly, materially affected the rate of growth in the United States this year, in 2010, and has made it more difficult for the United States to climb out of the recession. So this is non-trivial stuff. This is pocketbook stuff in Topeka, as well as in Europe. It started in Athens, in Greece, in the spring. It's since spread, of course, to Ireland. This is Dublin Castle. And the big worry now that a bailout fund has been set up for both Greece and Ireland is that the debt crisis will expand to, anybody know what this one is? It's El Escorial in Madrid. This is the big fish in the European debt crisis. If it gets to Spain, which is a much bigger economy than Greece or Ireland, which are relatively marginal economies, then we've got serious problems. And is it going to get to Spain? Spain's economy, neither Spain's economy nor its financial system is seriously at risk, but is seriously flawed, certainly as much as the Greeks' system was. But it doesn't. The reality of it does not matter. It's the perception in the markets that matter, and the perception in the markets has fluctuated between panic and nervousness for several months now. And a quick trip into panic, and we could see serious problems as we did in the fall of 2008. As I said earlier, if you look at the European debt crisis and the dollar. This is the dollar against our broad currency index. You can see that through most of the recession, the dollar fell, making our exports less expensive and imports more expensive. This was to our advantage. But in 2010, you had this big bump up around the European debt crisis, and it's that second bump over on the right-hand side that we really don't want to repeat because of events in Europe. There's also the possibility of real estate disaster 2.0. This picture is of a very small house in the tiny hamlet of Denmark, Maine, and it is ground zero for what could be real estate disaster 2.0, which is the foreclosure crisis. The owner of this house had the bank foreclose on it, and he did something that most homeowners, when foreclosed upon, do not do. He got a lawyer. And the lawyer found all kinds of deficiencies in the foreclosure processing on the house, and the result of that was essentially the question of whether banks even had the right to foreclose on most of the properties that they were foreclosing on, threatening the orderly workout of the real estate disaster 1.0. This has faded from the news and may not be as big an issue as you might as the original headline suggested, but it has not been resolved. There are still serious questions out there and mountains of lawsuits across the country challenging the bank's rights to do foreclosures, which could upset the processing of the real estate and the return of the real estate market to some kind of orderly growth. Today's the day when the Republicans take over in the House of Representatives, and Governor LePage is sworn in Augusta. In Augusta, this will be the first time that the Republicans have had the governorship, the Senate and State Senate and the State House since 1964. John Reed was governor then. The Republicans have never governed in total in Maine since the income tax was introduced in 1970. So these are truly revolutionary times. One of the big reasons for optimism in the next year, as I'll talk about in a little bit, is the tax deal that was reached. Extending the Bush tax cuts, our assumptions had been that the Bush tax cuts would be extended, but the payroll tax cut that was agreed to as part of that deal is a big deal. That's another $100 to $120 million stimulus. I didn't say that. Which, as I'll talk about when I do the, when I turn to the main forecast in a minute, will have a potentially profound effect. The problem is, though, of that $100 billion that tax cut will put into the economy, the Republican majority in the House has pledged to cut federal spending by $100 billion, thus negating the stimulative effect. And so the $100 billion in this fiscal year. So if they were to carry through on their campaign promise, the payroll tax cut would have net zero effect on the economy. Turning to Maine, it's been a horrible year to be an economist in Maine, not because it's been a bad year, but because we've had all kinds of problems with our numbers. I won't go into the details. It's a bunch of complicated things, including involving things called autoregressive integrated moving averages and a program called X12. But let's just say that the result has been that measuring Maine's employment growth this year, 2010, has been extraordinarily difficult. What I've shown you here is the blue bars, which are sort of up and down. You can see kind of an irregular pattern to them. Some months way up. The official numbers showed a growth of 4,000 jobs in leisure and hospitality and restaurants and hotels in the middle of mud season, and the loss of those jobs in the summer. See, we have reasons to doubt this. The other bar represents not seasonally adjusted data year over year. And here I think you can see the pattern a little more clearly. Through 2009, employment fell very steadily on a year-over-year basis. Beginning in 2010, the fall began to moderate significantly, and by the end of 2010 had turned modestly positive on both the seasonally adjusted and the not seasonally adjusted basis. At the end of the day, we think that Maine employment will be down slightly for 2010, which is actually pretty close to where my forecast was, I'll talk about in a minute. I mentioned hours worked have been steadily increasing in Maine. You'll see in this graph that that's been true in Maine and the U.S., but there's a big fall in November. This is probably sampling error related to the issue I just talked about, so I don't necessarily believe it. I'm just treating it as a kind of warning at this point. Maine actually got through this recession better than the U.S. as a whole. We lost fewer jobs as a percentage of our economy, about 5% versus 6.5% at the U.S. level. That's not to say that it wasn't bad, but in general, our economy did not lose as many jobs, and we actually, as the revisions have come in, things are actually looking up in terms of the economy. All of the evidence in the revised data that we're seeing, economic data takes about 2 years to become final as companies complete their reports and errors are corrected and so on. And most of the revisions that have been made have been pushing our numbers to the better side as opposed to the worse side. Better side, so 30,100 instead of 30,400, you know, that's what I'm talking about. Still, we'll take those 300 jobs. Our unemployment rate, with the exception of 1 month in 2009, early 2009, has been consistently below the national average. The national unemployment rate has been around 9.5% to 10%. We are now down below well below 8%. The most recent numbers almost at 7%. However, I caution you that the unemployment rate at this stage of the recession is a very unreliable indicator. Our unemployment rate has been going down mostly because people have been reporting themselves as not in the labor force. If you take the people who are not in the labor force, they're essentially of working age and have had jobs but are no longer looking for jobs, if you take those people into account, our unemployment rate is probably around 9.1%, the U.S. unemployment rate probably around 11.2%. So we're still well below the national average, but you got to, the absolute numbers are deceptive and do not adequately express the real level of household pain that is out there caused by this employment crisis. So let's look at the forecast. This is, in truth, you know, I've taken over the years to coming back to you in January and saying, okay, here's what I said a year ago. Let's see how I did. It's only fair. So last year I said that Maine in 2010 would lose about 1.3% in employment, would gain about 2011 about 1.3%, in 2012 about 3.1%, and 2.9% in 2013. Actual performance in 2010 was 0.9% drop, a little less, but given the margin of error for the forecasting, pretty accurate. And particularly, now admittedly all of that, a lot of that messiness in the numbers I talked about before are smoothed out at the annual level. They're really month-to-month variations. So I think at the end of the day, this number will come out pretty much right. However, you'll notice that my forecast that I prepared for the New England Economic Partnership this fall is significantly lower in 2011 through 2013, dropping from 1.3% to 0.6%, from 3.1% to 2% in 2012, and 2.9 to 2.6% in 2013. The major reason for this drop is a dramatic slowing in the national forecast caused by the 2010 events, including the European debt crisis. I also dropped my forecast in two areas. I cut the rate of growth in healthcare employment in half, mostly because of hospital layoffs. Hospitals have been laying people off because of patient volume drops caused by people without health insurance being able to go to the hospital and get treatment. So patient staffing in hospitals is very dependent on volumes, and hospitals have been doing layoffs. That plus healthcare reform, I've pulled my forecast for healthcare growth to about half the growth rate that it has been. I've also kept state and local government employment constant for the next 5 years. I've let it grow at zero. I've let it have no growth. Now, I don't know what the governor's budget is going to show. I don't know what how that's all going to play out in terms of employment. The zero growth is simply the safest assumption. I think that depending on what the governor and legislature do, you could see zero growth is kind of the upper end, or you could see it significant cuts in state and local workforce over the next several years, which would affect the employment outlook as a whole. I mentioned the tax cuts. I haven't done a reforecast since the tax cuts were enacted. I've done some kind of mental calculations based on my experience and based on my information I have from Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics, with whom we work to do our forecasting. I think that if the tax cuts package is not significantly altered otherwise in fiscal policy, a back-of-the-envelope forecast for 2011, basically I'm going to return to where I was a year ago and suggest Maine employment growth at about 1.2%, about 3% in 2012, and the same in 2013. This is very preliminary. It's not calculated through the models. It's just a round number guess. But I think it's probably reasonable in terms of the size of the payroll tax cut and its effect on the economy. So basically, I'm starting off the year with a little more optimistic forecast, because I think the monetary and fiscal policy plus the fundamentals are all poised to see much more in the way of growth than I was seeing even when I put my fall forecast together a couple of months ago. However, the recovery to pre-COVID recession levels in Maine will still take a while. Last year, I forecast that we would recover to 620,000 jobs in 2012 Q3. In my fall forecast this year, I have that pushed off to 2014 Q1, largely because of the factors I talked about in terms of Maine and the national economy. If 2011 turns out to be as good as I think, or better than I just described because of the payroll tax cut, we could get back to our pre-recession level probably in mid-2013. But we're looking still at 2 to 3 more years before we're back to where we were in 2008. Very quickly, most of the job sectors in Maine will not recover to pre-recession levels by 2014 quarter two. Construction will not, manufacturing will not, retail trade will not, information, finance, the only one, or government. None of these will get back to pre-recession levels by the time the state as a whole gets back under my fall forecast, which would be 2014 Q2. The only sectors that will get back, the ones that we're going to rely upon, healthcare, leisure and hospitality, and professional and business services. Professional and business services, pretty much everything that gets done in Portland and the urban areas. Professional and business services is now, along with healthcare and to some extent leisure and hospitality, the drivers of job growth in Maine. And professional and business services is a really key one because it tends to be now the high-wage, high-skill jobs in that area, which is exactly why Mike and the business leaders who are concerned about the future of higher education are right on point, because that's exactly where the Maine economy is going and where its demands are going to be. One final piece of good news. Naval Air Station Brunswick closes May 2011. It will be turned over to civilian control completely. It is now largely closed. You can go up to Naval Air Station Brunswick and drive around it. All you have to do is show a picture ID at the gate, and you can drive anywhere you want. It's now open for business. And they have secured their first private sector tenant, Kestrel Aviation, which will be doing maintenance, repair, and overhaul on aircraft. Final few points on the deficit. Which road to the future? You will hear a lot about the deficit. This is a quick primer on some of the basic arguments. Here you see the basic problem. The green line represents the CBO, what's called alternative fiscal scenario. This represents what our debt to GDP ratio will look like if we continue our current policies. The red line represents current law, but current law does not reflect current policy, because we know the Republicans want to extend the Bush tax cuts. We know that a whole variety of things like the alternative minimum tax, which Congress fixes every year, and there's the so-called doc fix, which cuts spending on Medicare reimbursement to doctors by 25%. That's in law, but it has to be fixed every year because the doctors show up and say, wait a minute, you can't cut my wages 25% and have me expect me to see the same number of patients. Sorry, it doesn't work like that. So they come in and come up with a fix. So that's the red line. The blue line represents the Bowles Simpson proposal. I'll talk about that in a minute. Essentially, here's the problem. In the long term, between 2010 and 2040, the black line represents revenues expected for the federal government. But as you can see, beginning in 2020, actually even now, but particularly into 2020 to 2040, essentially existing revenues are no longer capable of covering what amounts to are only able to cover what amounts to net interest on the debt, Social Security, and a portion of Medicare. So beginning in 2020, or somewhere between 2020 and 2030, leaving the existing revenue structure of the federal government will only be able to pay for interest on the debt, Social Security, and some portion of Medicare. Everything else has to be borrowed or gotten rid of, beginning in about 2025. You either must get rid of the entire federal government or you must borrow the money to pay for it. And as you borrow the money to pay for it, the interest on the debt, of course, keeps mounting. This is essentially the problem that we face. Let's just quickly agree on some terms. The deficit is the annual difference between, or surplus, the annual difference between revenues and expenditures. The debt is the total amount of outstanding U.S. government bonds, maturation at any interest rate. And we measure this in a whole bunch of different ways, and I don't want to confuse you with this. I'm going to keep essentially to the national income accounting rules, but I can guarantee you, depending on whether you look at the consolidated budget, there are about 40 different definitions of the debt and the deficit. We're going to keep it simple, and we're just going to use the term deficit, and we're going to use the national income basis for talking about this. This is not one problem, but three problems. The first problem is in the short term. From 2008 to about 2013, it is primarily a revenue problem. From about 2013 to about 2020, it is a structural problem of taxes and spending once the recovery has fully engaged. Tax policy, health policy, defense spending, and discretionary spending. Beyond 2020, the problem is healthcare, and interest rates. That's it. So we got three different sets of problems, and we got to deal with them on three different levels. First, there is this idea that the government spending has gotten out of control over the last 2 years. The red line shows the rate of government, federal government spending from 2000 quarter one to 2010 quarter two. As you can see, with a couple of little bumps around the recession, the trajectory, the slope of that curve has not essentially changed. What has changed is the revenue curve. The revenue curve fell first because of the Bush tax cuts and then because of the recession. The deficit that exists today is primarily a problem of the fact that we, as a result of the recession, cannot, and as a result of the tax cuts enacted, choose not to collect enough revenues to fund the level of government that we have pretty much enjoyed consistently for the last decade. Indeed, if we look at the situation today, taxes as a percentage of personal income, which have averaged around 11%, are back at the levels of the early Eisenhower administration. The amount of taxes being collected out of personal income in the U.S. are about where they were in 1952. This is the federal government. And incidentally, it's also true in Maine, not back to 1952, but we're back to about to where we were in 1970. What do we spend our dollars on, our federal tax dollars on? Today, we spend it 21% on Medicare and Medicaid, 20% on Social Security. Defense spending is 20%. Our defense spending at 20% of our budget is more than the entire rest of the world combined. Other mandatory spending, unemployment insurance, assistance to the needy, and so on, 17%. 16% is everything else, and 6% is interest on the debt. So everything that you think of as the federal government, the National Park Service, the Internal Revenue Service, EPA, the FBI, all of those things, that's 16% of the federal budget. It's the vast majority of what we spend our money on are transfers in medical care and defense. Two commissions have proposed solutions. The first one is the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. This is the President's Commission, the so-called Bull-Simpson Commission. They issued a report called The Moment of Truth. I'm not going to go through all of this in detail. This will be up on the website and downloadable. But essentially, the basic components I'll just describe the basic components. Both commissions propose a payroll tax holiday, which has now been implemented. Both commissions seek to broaden the base of the income tax by reducing tax expenditures, eliminating capital gains preferences, capping mortgage interest rate deductions, taxing more of the employer-provided health care benefits, capping charitable deductions, and eliminating tax preferences for municipal bonds. This commission proposes income tax rates of 12, 22, and 28% and a 15% increase in the gas tax. On spending, they propose capping discretionary spending growth to half that rate of inflation, equal percent cuts in defense and non-defense spendings, a whole variety of processes, which are kind of boring to anybody outside the federal government, and a variety. There's an entire chapter on health spending reform, which is mind-numbingly detailed if you're outside the healthcare field. Their basic target is we want government to be no more than 21% of GDP. That's their approach. The second one is the so-called Bipartisan Policy Center. Both of these reports, incidentally, are freely available on the web. Restoring America's Future. How many reports have I seen called Restoring America's Future? Let me see. The first one I can think of is Terrell Bell's report on education in 1983. Economic growth, you'll notice the payroll tax holiday, reducing tax expenditures, lowering the rates. This commission wants two rates, 15 and 27%. This commission proposes what's called a 6.5% debt reduction value-added tax. They would tax more consumption than the Bowles-Simpson Commission. And they would raise the FICA cap, the current $108,000. They would raise that over 38 years. They would freeze for 4 years and then cap discretionary expenditures to rise with the rate of GDP growth, processes to identify other cuts, health spending reform. And one of the things these guys came up with, which I thought was an interesting twist, you may remember the argument about the so-called public option in the debate about health care. Well, they proposed to make Medicare a public option for people over 65 and allow people over 65 to get into the health insurance markets that are being set up under the health care reform bill. Their target is debt at 60% of GDP. They make no target of how big the federal government should be. They simply say we should not borrow more than 60% of our have not more than 60% of our annual income outstanding in debt. As you can see here, this is the slide I showed earlier, the commission proposal. This is Bowles-Simpson. They bring debt to GDP down to around 30% by 2040. Whereas the bipartisan commission achieves their goal of a 60% debt to GDP by 2020 and maintains that over the next 20 years. All right, 1.5 cheers. The commissions get it right that there are three ingredients, not just tax cuts, not just expenditure cuts, but economic growth is the third key ingredient. 1% extra growth over the next 20 years in the GDP takes away almost half the problem. So growth plus moderation of spending and some increased revenues basically solves the problem. Every ox gets a little gored. Every ox is going to have to get gored, though in America we do not gore oxes easily. And there are all kinds of creative ideas for dealing with the deficit and the debt problem in these reports. If you're into this stuff, it's a catalog of ideas that have been hanging around out there in the policy community for years. But there are things not to cheer. There is no exactly right size of government. 21%, well, why not 22%? Why not 23? If you set 21%, in fact, it's already happened. You see Republican candidates for president outbidding each other. Mitt Romney has said, I can do that government in 19% of GDP. And pretty soon you're going to have ratcheting down until somebody stands up and says, I can do government in 2%. Well, come on, guys. There's no right answer to this question. Neither in theory nor in practice is there a right answer to this question. Targeting debt and deficits as the size of as a proportion of the economy creates recognizable fiscal limits without making arbitrary choices for ourselves and our heirs about what level of government they should have. Secondly, the impacts on the fiscal system as a whole, state and local governments, are largely ignored in both reports until the governors and the legislatures get to weigh in on the right balance between federal, state, and local systems in this debt reduction debate. We could find ourselves in a situation in which the federal government solves its problem largely by passing it on to state and local governments. That's not a solution either. Both reports ignore the other major crisis we face, which is climate change. Climate change is not on the horizon of people who deal with the federal deficit. It should be. In the next 20 to 30 years, we could have a Hurricane Katrina-style scale bailout of a major American city every 1 to 3 years. The costs will run into trillions of dollars to repair the damages done by climate change. No one is making any provision for that. No one is thinking about the fiscal implications of climate change and the cost of fixing the problem now versus later. But if we do not fix the problem now, just as with the deficit, costs are going to be orders of magnitude higher to the economy and to the government. We are not going to get to the situation in which Houston or Miami is wiped out and the government simply says, sorry, we don't do that. We don't have enough money to fix you. That's not going to happen, and so if we ignore the twin relationships between the threats to our natural ecosystems and to our urban and coastal systems and this serious problem of how we pay for and what we do with government, I think we're going to the disaster will be compounded. These are finally expert solutions that do not fundamentally, and they will cheerfully tell you, I've talked with members of both commissions, they will cheerfully tell you we have not solved the fundamental problem, which is that Americans want substantially more government than they are willing to pay for. Until we find a way to solve that problem, the rest of this is interesting debate. We have to find a story that people will believe that this is a problem worth solving and that it can be solved. The right size of government argument, as I've suggested, just doesn't work. There is no right size of government. The fair distribution of burdens. Whatever we do has got to be fair. Absolutely true. Anything perceived as unfair is out the door. But what do you do when everybody feels oppressed? What do you do when everybody is a victim? How do we find fairness? What is fairness when all of us feel we are the ones being put upon? This is a major challenge to find what really is a fair and that people will perceive as fair without necessarily saying that fairness means I don't have to pay anything. And finally, I think the one story that can work is how do we choose between the present and the future? If we change the debate from the right size of government to what do we do now and what do we invest in for the future, maybe we can have some discussions. So we're back to the cliff. The cliff in this case, of course, is the longer term issue. If you stand in front of the cliffs of Moher, which is what this is in Western Ireland, what you see in front of you is this. Now, you would think with this massive cliff overlooking the ocean, windswept, sheer drop of 400 feet to the rocky shore below, you would not need a sign that says, don't jump off the cliff. Apparently, you do. The implication of this, I think, is that the debt problem, the deficit problem, from an economic perspective, is an eminently solvable problem. There are lots of ways to do it efficiently and equitably. The two commissions and others out there have tons of ideas. This is a solvable problem if we want to solve it. The question is, do we want to solve it? Do we really want to come up and say that this is something we have to deal with, that everybody's going to have to pay a part in it. Everybody's going to have to play a part in terms of services they get, in terms of taxes that they pay. Or are we just going to have to stick signs up all over the country and say, remember, don't jump off the cliff? Thanks.
You've been listening to the University of Southern Maine's Muskie School of Public Service Professor of Public Policy and Management, Charles Colgan's Economic Forecast for 2011, which took place recently at USM in Portland. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can find the audio along with the slides used in the presentation online at mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. A service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.